One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
What is going on, y'all? And thank all of y'all so very much for joining us here today on Expanded Perspectives with me, Cam Hale. And of course, I'm not alone. This fella has been beating the heat all day. Calphus.
How's it going, everybody? Yes, I'm here in Skeleton Studios getting ready to depart on my summer trip. But you know how it goes when you try to leave town, everything falls in your lap at the last second. I love it. It happens to me every time. I think sometimes I'm just going to pretend I'm going out of town just so I can get more work.
But, just got to tell the universe you're leaving.
I'm almost done with that. Everybody's getting ready to go. Because when we get back, I think the kids got like a week or two and then school's back in session. This is like the fastest summer.
Yeah.
I can remember. I mean, it is accelerating.
You're not hating on it. You're just saying.
I'm not hating.
Get them kids out of my hair and out of my house.
Right.
Back to school.
Speaking of things that accelerate fast, unlike my hair loss, I'm talking about UAPs. Have you noticed all the stuff going on the last 2 weeks with Congress meeting with David Fravor, Ryan Graves, and David Grush? And, you know, it's coming out. Again, these whistleblowers talking about how we do have a secret extraterrestrial retrieval program.
We've got bodies.
We've got ships. We've had it this whole time. You know, dude. And everybody in Congress looks like, what? What are you talking about? And at first, it does kind of seem far-fetched. How could they not know? But if you think about it, a lot of times whenever you have a government contract, it's with a private company. Like, you know, the Sig Sauer just started making, you know, the gun that replaced the M249 and stuff with the M250. But that's Sig Sauer is a private company. You know, Surefire Suppressors, you know, that's a private company. Mm-hmm. So there's private companies in aeronautics like Lockheed Martin, you know, Northrop Grumman, all these places and companies like
Bigelow
that.
Bigelow Aerospace.
So if there was a crashed UFO, UAP, whatever you want to call it, wouldn't it make sense that it was retrieved and taken back to like Lockheed's secret base? And maybe, you know, people up in the most of government are not aware because it's a trade secret. Like if we had a secret sauce, a secret recipe for something, I don't want my competitors to find it. So if one aerospace corporation finds it and they can recover it and then reverse engineer it, I can start to see how it's not, a lot of people may not know. I mean, Bob Lazar, when he was talking about it, he was like, everything was compartmentalized. So you were working on one particular part. You're not aware of the other parts. So it keeps people from, you know, whistleblowing. But every once in a while, somebody falls through the cracks. And that's what happened with this David Grush guy. And he spilled the beans. Now, I will say, he himself said he never actually saw any aliens. He never actually saw any of these craft. But he's just heard from reputable people that were read into the same clearance level as he has, that he believes 100% were not lying. And he's heard it from different people, and they all tell the similar tale. So I will say there's that, right? Like, I know the guy's probably looking to write some books soon, and so by doing this, it's going to boost the sale of his books.
Get that buzz going.
But, you know, at the same time, we do this podcast, and UFOs is one of my favorite topics. We've been talking about it forever, and I remember it's what got me interested even as a small kid. Part of me believes him 100% because I've always thought that they've been coming here. I think when the Roswell crash happened, remember, and it was even the local newspapers talked about how that's what they reported it as, a UFO crashed, and then they quickly came in, scooped it all up, and changed the story, remember? But I think they kind of dropped the ball that the first story was the real story. And then you hear about guys like Bob Lazar that, you know, everybody tried to discredit him. They say he lied about where his education. He never worked at Los Alamos. But then it comes out later George Knapp did all that research back in the 80s and stuff. And now, man, people knew him. Bob knew the layout of the building. He didn't make any of that up. And then later, like Moscovium, Element 115 coming out. Turns out everything Bob said has been truthful. So I don't think Bob is a liar, just like I don't think Mr. Grush is a liar. Mm-hmm. I think we have had a recovery team operation. We have an exact plan. We have a place where they're stored. Of course, there's pilots of these entities. Non-human is all they're calling them at this point. I believe those stories 100%.
What it makes me feel like is you ever caught like a your partner or a loved one or a good friend. You catch them in a lie.
Yeah.
And you don't say anything. And they don't say anything. And then it comes up again and you start saying stuff. And they stick with that lie until you finally show them the proof. Like, look, you don't got to keep lying to me about it. Look, I know what this is what happened. And then they tell you.
Yeah.
That's what it feels like. Because it just it feels like we've all already known. Everybody listening, we've all already known that this is a thing. We just wanted them to admit that, yeah, we've lied to you. That's all I want you to do is admit to it. We don't need you to tell us anything about it. We just need you to admit what's going on. Because now it starts making you reevaluate every abduction story you hear.
Yeah.
Every crash site, like the one in Brazil. You start reevaluating every bit of that now.
Right. And I feel bad for the Congress people because, like, they don't know. They've been lied to as well. Mm-hmm. It's not just us.
Well, John it goes Q way deeper than just what we need to know. Think about all the we've been living on this planet this whole time. There's a really good chance they've been living here with us this entire time also.
I think so.
So it's just
I mean, they just like David Fravor was talking about, these things have always been there. They just weren't able to detect them till they put on a new radar system. And then that new advanced system is when they started picking them up.
And they could be living, I mean, right along beside you. May work with some. I mean, we have no idea. It may truly be like all of the movies that you see where they've taken on our appearance, right? Wasn't there just a woman? There's just something on the news the other day where the woman in Dallas was yelling about this guy that looked like some shapeshifter.
Yeah, she was on an airplane. Yeah. Everybody's, I'm sure, seen that on Instagram.
Like, so, I mean, who knows? What if it's true?
Maybe she's not crazy, right? Maybe she saw a reptilian eye.
Well, it makes you start wondering about a lot of stuff when these things come up.
It's crazy that it's all coming out right now. So either it's finally happening or they're really trying to distract us from something else.
True. Very true.
I think that every time anything comes out. But no, I think it's just it's been hidden for so long that eventually it's going to come out. And it doesn't seem that too many people are that shocked by it.
Yeah.
Like, I haven't met one person that's like, oh, that's blown ridiculous. Away. Everybody's like, yeah, makes sense. I mean, sounds.
Well, and maybe it was one of those things. It took this long. So what I mean is, like, they've told us, you know, from all this, they've played it off, but then they've been making movies for 60, 70 years of alien movies. It took this long to condition you to where the entire culture wouldn't go into shock when they go, oh, by the way, all that we've showed you real is real.
Yeah, yeah.
And maybe that's what it took.
All the stories.
Yeah.
Like Hillary Clinton's a reptilian and maybe. All this stuff. Maybe that's Nancy Pelosi's a reptilian.
It's Kyle Filson saying that, folks, not me.
No, I'm just saying it's possible, right?
It is
I'm joking.
Possible.
I'm joking. You know, like, sometimes I don't believe that there's like reptilians running the government.
I don't believe that.
I do believe that there's extraterrestrials visiting the planet. I'll say that.
Yeah. Or just living here.
Yeah. Right.
That's it.
Yeah. They're in the ocean is where they're at.
I'll tell you what you don't want have visiting. And when I grabbed a hold of this, I thought instantly of you. A black-eyed kid story here.
No.
Yet listen to this. Says this incident involved my fiance in April of 2011. And to this day, she refuses to talk about it. But I decided to write it out here just to see what others can get out of it. So, and this is all from Lon here, says, so then we lived in Bangor, Maine. It was around 10:30 p.m. that evening. I was on a late shift at work, and she was home alone with our cat in the apartment. She said that she was reading while the cat slept in her lap. And then a moment later, the cat stands up, stared intently at the outside door, then, of course, meowed and ran off into the bedroom. Never acted like that before, so she assumed it was just a weird thing that cats do. Just as she got comfortable again, the doorbell rang. So she thought it was strange that someone would want to visit at this time of night. She got up and peeked through the hole, but saw nothing. So she turned away from the door when there were three loud knocks. Well, she was immediately alarmed, but curiosity got the best of her, and she cracked the door open to see who was there. She saw a boy, she says around 11 or 12, though short, standing there. So she opens the door to ask him what he wanted. She assumed that this child had either gotten locked out of another apartment or was just asking for help. That's when he looked up at her and she noticed his eyes. The light from the apartment spilled out into the hallway, affirming his black eyes. She claimed she was paralyzed by shock as the child demanded entry. By that time, the cat had come out of the bedroom and lay on the floor behind her, ears folded back and hissing. She said that she felt compelled to say yes, but as she stared into those cold black eyes, she suddenly slammed the door and locked the deadbolt. She claimed that she listened to the child's footsteps in the hallway but heard nothing. And after several terrifying minutes, she peeked out the door and the kid was gone or disappeared. She said she'd never been so scared in her life. She thought that the cat's hissing interrupted her paralysis, allowing her to regain her thoughts and quickly close the door. She's never discussed it, though I'm sure she wonders what may have happened if she had let that black-eyed boy into the apartment. See?
Yeah, good move on not letting it in. That's right. They always seem to demand that you let them in.
But I like how she brings up the fact that the cat snapped her out of it.
Yeah.
Which... You know, we've
I would like to swung the door open and be like this is Sparta, kick that kid
we've
right
We've always
off the porch,
talked about
quack,
that. Yeah.
Right into the wall and then slam the door and lock it.
Just teep
and then go
the
hide
kid.
In the back bedroom with my handgun.
Just teep him right off the front porch.
Yeah, kapow.
Just grab the door frame. Get out of here. Now your eyes are significantly black.
Yeah, very.
Nothing.
Very,
but then how would you explain like a 12-year-old black-eyed kid just beat you down?
Well, I think there are sightings where people do let them in and you just never hear from them because those people are gone.
Yeah, we've had the one story where it seems like that's what happened and the person passed away not long after that.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's a very strange thing. I still don't understand them.
I don't either.
I still feel like it's some sort of evil entity fae.
Sounds like it. Check this out. It says, "Dear sirs, my brother referred your email address to me. He thought you may have an answer to what I saw this past July while camping in the Sierra Nevada mountains near Tioga Lake, California. My teenage son and I were camping in our RV. There were other campers in the area, but not very close to us. On the third night of our trip, we encountered something that neither of us can explain. Now, this is bear country, and I know that there have been Bigfoot reports over the years, but what we saw was neither as far as we can tell. We secured all of the food and other supplies in the RV and were getting ready to go to bed. It was around 12:30 a.m. My son fell asleep quickly while I was getting a few things ready as we were going to leave this location later in the morning. I was looking at a map when I started to hear high-pitched screams. At first, I thought it was a coyote, but it was a single scream and sounded more human, like a woman's scream. I opened the RV door and stood silent in the doorway, just listening. Once again, the high-pitched scream started. Only this time, it woke my son. We both stood at the door as the screams continued from the direction of the mountains. After about 10 minutes, the screams stopped, so we both went to bed. Something startled me while I was sleeping because I woke up in a panic. I looked at my watch. It was 2:40 a.m., Then suddenly, that same high-pitched scream erupted outside of the RV. As it startled my son, he jumped up out of his rack and fell to the floor. I grabbed my .44, just in case. As we looked out through the windshield, the moonlight was bright enough to illuminate a tall, thin creature with light-colored skin. My son yelled, "Dad, it's a zombie!" It did look like a female human form, but the face and the rest of the body looked horrible. It reminded me of an old witch. It had no clothes, a deformed face, long, light-colored hair, long arms, and long, thin legs. I figured it stood almost 7 foot. It was walking away from the RV towards the lake. I had seen enough. I made sure everything was ready to go and drove out of there as soon as possible. We ended up near Mono Lake. A few days later, I was able to talk to a ranger as he walked through the camping area. He was an older guy and quite engaging. I described what we witnessed. My son also verified that what we had seen. The ranger got a serious look on his face and said that over the years, something similar had been reported more than a few times. He said they call it Penelope, but he didn't know why it had gotten that name. That's all he knew. When I got home, I searched the internet, but no information was available. My brother gave me your email address and said that you may have an idea of what we saw. I'd appreciate your help, LR. Well, I have no idea what you saw. Sorry.
It sounds almost rake-like.
Yeah, and do you think the calls, again, with the screaming, is like trying to lure you into the woods? We've talked about that so many times, but it's true. There's all these legends, whether they're from Japan to over here, is just there's these, it's like fae, I don't know, but it's like something, a puckwudgie is the same as a creature known to try to lure you into the woods. So maybe it was calling out at him, trying to get him to leave the RV and come out there. Or maybe it's just walking around screaming. I don't know.
Man, we do have a lot of stories where this mimicking sounds that we've talked about, where there's possibly children or crying or calls for help, does seem like it's something. Man,
it's spooky too.
First, there's no reason for anything to be that color pale and live in the woods.
No.
Right? Like, you understand, I get it. But you know what it makes me think of? Every time these come out, when they see these walkers or watchers, it instantly makes me think of the cave system. Because I always think of the little white, like salamanders or whatever. That's where they would come from. They only come out in the dark because the sunlight truly bothers their eyes. They can't see. They can't do these things. They come out in the evenings to mill around like that and call. And maybe the only reason they're coming out is because fewer and fewer people are going out into the woods. There's less to eat, right? More people are aware. Less people are traveling in these areas where they've lost people. Or when they do, they're more in groups. Things have changed over all these years of whatever lives down in there. I don't know, but that's what it always makes me think of.
Something like a rake almost. Yes. Like some kind of devolved human living in the cave system. Yeah, that's
just some sort of frightening. Yeah,
I could never be like a spelunker. No. I could never work in a coal mine. I was watching this documentary.
You can stop right there.
Where there was this coal miner cam in like Kentucky.
Stop.
And where he was at was 19 inches tall, but he was back in there like 700 feet.
Oh,
I'm like, in the dark, mind you. I'm like, dude, there's no way I could do that.
No.
Not to mention the spiders, the centipedes, whatever else is in there. I'm not about that life.
I used to tell them at the city that I will climb up on top of anything. Nothing's too high. But I am not going down inside of anything. Because if I fall off, it's my fault, right? It's something that I neglected, some sort of safety. But I can't control when the earth decides to just collapse.
Yeah, no, I'm with
you.
So
I'm out. It terrifies me, dude. I'm kidding you not. That whole idea, just like the whole cave system, that might be what's going on down there. I'll never know.
Yeah, I'm claustrophobic.
Never going. Yeah, I'm never going in there. I'm never going in the ocean. I just have to take y'all's words for it. Everything sounds awesome. That's great and all.
Yeah, I agree. Well, speaking of great, I got some great stories coming up after the break.
Yes.
Let's take that break. Stay with us. When we get back, I'm going to be talking about giants in the new world. Stay with us, folks. You're listening to Expanded Perspectives.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
As most of you know by now, I'm fascinated by the stories of giants. I mean, until about 7 years ago, I'd never even heard about the findings of the remains of actual giants. Other than tales of Paul Bunyan, Jack and the Beanstalk, the Jolly Green Giant on cans of vegetables, or the story of David versus Goliath from Sunday school as a kid, I had no idea that any of this was not only possible, but probable. You see, long before early Native Americans traveled over the natural land bridge from Asia and Alaska, there was already a race of very tall people here. Who knows how long they were already in North America? What was their culture like? What did their towns or villages look like? Man, I wish sometimes I had a time machine. Let's begin with what we are told about the history of North America in our schools. Mainstream archaeologists hold to the basic tenets of the Clovis First theory with almost religious zeal. This theory is so named for a specific type of arrow point found in Clovis, New Mexico, during the early half of the last century, and is considered by the establishment to be the holy grail of North American paleoarchaeology. In the estimation of these mainstream archaeologists, sporadic waves of migrations, beginning around 15,000 years ago, moved from Siberia across the Bering Strait and onward into Alaska. When an ice-free corridor opened up a few thousand years later, the Paleo-Indians, or as they are called, roamed southward into virgin territory, soon to occupy the whole of the Americas. In their view, this established the Clovis people as the New World's first culture. Now, many mainstream scientists now question this interpretation, but the number of academics who still cling to the old theory is truly staggering. Ample evidence suggests that, contrary to this view, that the New World was an unpopulated garden that became inhabited but a few short millennia ago. The New World is instead a land of vanished peoples and was the epicenter of a long-lost age of historical giants. It appears that giants dominated the Americas for hundreds of thousands of years before the arrival of Asian people from Siberia. In their book, The Suppressed History of America, Paul Schrag and Xavier Hayes, they demonstrate how the famous American explorers and adventurers, Lewis and Clark, encountered stories among the Native Americans of a fallen race of giants. Furthermore, in many cases, Lewis and Clark had their own close encounters with these beings. They wrote these encounters down and then suppressed the accounts in later publications. According to author Stephen Quayle, up until 5 centuries ago, the New World was still populated by living giants. Only in very recent times, the last few centuries, has evidence of living giants faded into the background. The only legends that persist are those of the mythical Sasquatch, which may or may not be a living species descended from Gigantopithecus. In 1519, Spanish explorer Alonso Alvarez de Pineda mapped the entire Gulf Coast region, marking the various rivers and bays, noticeable landmarks, and porting areas, all of which were the exclusive property of the King of Spain. After covering the entire coastlines of Florida and as far south as Tampico, Mexico, he returned up the Mississippi River, a journey he would never forget. Pineda was the first European ever to have ventured up the mouth of the Mississippi. He returned with an unbelievable account. Now, according to Pineda, he found a large settlement of villages inhabited by, you guessed it, giants. Pineda also claimed that these giants were very friendly, and after some time, he and his crew settled among them. There they rested, made repairs, and resupplied their food stocks, preparing for the journey onward. Now, Pineda noted that there was an abundance of gold throughout the Mississippi, and that the natives adorned themselves with the gold jewelry, and they worshipped golden idols. now rather atypical for a Spaniard of his time, Pineda was less concerned with finding gold in the Mississippi and more captivated by the discovery of new lands and food and the shock of finding a race of giants living among the native population. After Pineda arrived back at his home base on the Caribbean island of Jamaica, he mentioned additional settlements of giants he encountered on all types of islands all the way up the Texas coast. He then presented Francisco de Garay, the Spanish governor of Jamaica, with his maps of the entire Gulf Coast, along with the sketches and impressions of its inhabitants. These writings, archived by the famous Spanish compiler, Martin Fernandez de Navarrete, can be found by visiting the Archivo General de Indias in Seville, Spain. 20 years later, the renowned Spanish explorer Francisco Coronado led an expedition across the American Southwest in the search of the legendary seven cities of Cibola, known today as El Dorado. Now, throughout his quest, the expedition encountered numerous tribes of Indian giants. The man responsible for documenting those close encounters was Pedro de Castaneda, who traveled with Coronado and wrote first-hand accounts of the histories of the expedition. Now, Castaneda's book describes the fascinating journey and discusses the adventures of a key crew member, Hernando de Alarcón, regarding the interactions with living giants among the North American Indians of the Southwest. Now, Schrag and Hayes explain the adventure. Low on provisions, a frantic Coronado sent Alarcón to find a river that could bring supplies more easily to the Spanish outposts along the California and Mexican coasts. After nearly destroying his ships and missing the waiting party at the rendezvous point, Alarcón haphazardly floated up the mouth of the murky Colorado River. Now, Alarcón and his men became the first Europeans to fight through the rough rapids as he brought his fleet into the heart of the Colorado River, reaching as far as the lower reaches of the Grand Canyon. Now, while coasting up the river, Alarcón and his men came upon a settlement of estimated 200 giant warriors. These giants, amazed by foreign intruders, were on the riverbanks and were ready to attack. Now, Alarcón, however, averted conflict by offering them gifts and entering in a peace treaty with the imposing natives. This quickly diffused the situation, and Alarcón and his fleet were permitted to continue unmolested by the natives. These giants were later identified as belonging to the Cocopa Indians. Even more of these giant tribesmen were found further upstream. So, you may be saying to yourself right now, yeah, Kyle, this all sounds great, the stories and all, but is there any archaeological findings that support the legends? And my answer is, there are. There have been sophisticated stone tools that have been found in an ancient Mexican stream bed, along with various other sites all over North America where these artifacts and objects have been found. These artifacts were considerably more advanced than even those used by the European and the Near Eastern populations 35,000 to 40,000 years ago. In addition to the incredibly ancient artifacts, some being as old as 250,000 years old, there were enormous walled cities and fortifications that have been found scattered across the United States. According to Brad Steiger, in Rockwall, Texas, which is the smallest county in Texas, 4 square miles support the great stone walls of an ancient fortification, some of which reach heights of 49 feet. The walls are about 8 inches thick. The stones have been placed on top of each other, and with the ends breaking the center of the stone, above or below, just as a fine mason would build a wall. The stones give the appearance of having been beveled around their edges. Now, we've spoken to people about this so-called stone wall in Rockwall, Texas. You've probably heard us discuss it on the show. We even had Scott Walter on the show one time. We interviewed him, and he did an entire episode on it on his TV show called America Unearthed. Now, he doesn't seem to think that the stone wall is real, but on the show, he only dug in one spot. So, maybe what he found wasn't a stone wall, but that doesn't mean the stone wall doesn't exist. Me and Cam both have spoken with a gentleman named Josh Reeves, Now, he's an author, documentary filmmaker, and the host of a radio show called The Global Reality. And in one of his documentary series called The Lost Secrets of Ancient America, he talks all about this stone wall. Me and Cam actually ran into him at a conference a few years ago, and not only did he talk to us about it, but he offered to take us to a spot where we can actually see it. Sounds like something we need to get around to doing. But anyway, that's not the only wall. There were also rumors of a vanished tribe that constructed an 885-foot wall on Fort Mountain in northern Georgia. The walls run east to west and overshadow numerous pits or foxholes from which it is imagined defenders repelled invading armies. Examples of massive stone walls and fortified cities in ancient America before the arrival of the Europeans could add to a renowned confidence in Native American ingenuity. But indigenous groups themselves maintain that these structures and artifacts are not products of their own engineering or their ability, but rather credit them to a race of giants known by a variety of names throughout the Americas and ancient Polynesia. Early 19th century treasure hunters often dug into so-called Indian mounds of the American Midwest. They were doing this in hopes of finding gold or precious jewels. Instead, they sometimes broke into an ancient burial containing skeletons of giants. Often they couldn't believe what they had found might actually be giant bones, and for nearly 200 years, scientists rationalized that these oversized human remains only appeared as such because the bones proportionally disarticulate in the soil over time. Now, beginning in the 1960s, however, improved excavation techniques and forensic procedures determined that the mound's skeletal evidence did, in fact, belong to individuals of extraordinary stature. Even mainstream archaeologists came to admit that first millennium Americans, academically referred to as the Adena, were at least occasionally given to physical height far above the modern average. Some of these specimens were 7 feet 2 inches in length, although unofficial sources report other specimens being as tall as 9 feet. None of this came to a surprise to Native American record keepers, who have long told of the Ronagong Wetowanka, or fair-skinned giant sorcerers that once strode the American plains. The following account is from the St. John Daily News, dated September 13, 1878, in its headline, "The Indian Chief Chickasabwa, Skeletons 8 and 10 feet in height." The article goes on to say, 2 miles west of Barfield Point, in Arkansas County, Arkansas, on the east bank of the lovely stream called the Pemiscot River, stands an Indian mound, some 25 feet high, and about an acre in area at the top. This mound is called Chickasabwa, and from it, the high and beautiful country surrounding some 12 square miles in area also derives its name, Chickasabwa. The mound derives its name, Chickasabwa, from a chief of the Shawnee tribe who lived, died, and was buried there. This chief was one of the last of the race of hunters who lived in that beautiful region and who once peopled it quite thickly. From 1820 to 1831, his hunters assembled annually at Barfield Point, then as now the principal shipping place of the surrounding country, and bartered off their furs, peltries, buffalo robes, and honey to the white settlers and the trading boats on the river, receiving in return powder, shot, lead, blankets, money, etc. Aunt Kitty Williams, who now resides there, relates that Chickasabwa would frequently bring in for sale at one time as much as 20 gallons of pure honey in deerskin bags slung over his back. He was always a firm friend of the whites, a man of gigantic stature and Herculean strength. In his 19th year, he took a young wife and by her had 2 children. In 1831, she died, and the old chief did not long survive her, dying in the same year, aged 93 or 94 years. Mr. W. Fitzgerald, who moved in that country in 1822, says that up until the time of his death, Chickasabwa supplied him with game. He was buried at the foot of the mound on which he lived, by the tribe, most of whom departed for the nation immediately after performing the funeral rites. A few, however, lingered there up until a late date, the last of them, we believe, being John East, who in 1860, at the breaking out of the war, joined Captain Charlie Bowen's company of the late so-called and fought the war through as a gallant a Reb as any of them, coming back home in 1866 to return to the arts of peace. Now Chickasawba was perfectly honest and the best informed chief of his tribe. His contemporary chiefs were Long Knife, Sunshine, Cornmeal, Moonshine, etc. Mike Brennan and Quill buried him. He left a son named John Pemscott. A number of years ago, in making an excavation into or near the foot of the Chickasawba's mound, a portion of a gigantic human skeleton was found. The men, who were digging, becoming interested, unearthed the entire skeleton, and, from measurements given us by the reliable parties, the frame of the man whom it belonged to could not have been less than 8 or 9 feet in height. Under the skull, which easily slipped over the head of our informant, was found a peculiarly shaped earthen jar, resembling nothing in the way of Indian pottery, which had before been seen by them. It was exactly the shape of a round-bodied, long-necked water decanter, a specimen of which may be seen on Gatson's dining table. The material of which the vase was made was a peculiar kind of clay, and the workmanship was very fine. The belly or body of it was ornamented with figures or hieroglyphics, consisting of a correct delineation of human hands, parallel to each other, open palms outward, and running up and down the vase, the wrists to the base and the fingers towards the neck. On the other side of the hands were tibia or thigh bones, also correctly delineated, running around the base. There were other things found with the skeleton, but this is all that our informant remembers. Since that time, whenever an excavation has been made in the Chickasawba County, in the neighborhood of the mound, similar skeletons have been found, and under the skull of every one were found similar funeral vases, almost exactly like the one described. There are now, in this city, several of the vases and proportions of huge skeletons. One of the editors of the newspaper yesterday measured a thigh bone, which is fully 3 feet long. The thigh and shin bones, together with the bones of the foot, stood up in a proper position in a physician's office in this city, measure 5 feet in height, and show the body to which the leg belonged to have been 9 to 10 feet high. At Buford's Landing near Buford, in digging up the leg of which measured between 5 and 6 feet in length, and other bones in proportion. In a few days, we hope to be able to lay before our readers accurate measurements of skeletons now in the city and of the articles found in the graves. It is not a matter of doubt that these are human remains, but of a long extinct race, a race which flourished, lived, and died here many centuries ago. Here's another newspaper account from the 19th century. It was published in the Huron Exeter newspaper in Ontario, Canada, on October 13, 1893. Its headline, "Men of Great Stature Found at Two Large Burial Sites in Nebraska." The article goes on to say, "A farmer plowing near Calhoun, Nebraska, recently turned up a human skull, and the search revealed a large number of other skulls besides bones. These relics were those of a powerful race, and who they were is unknown. The skulls are large, but the forehead is extremely low. A World Herald reporter visited the place, and the measurement was taken of one of the lower jaws found and compared with the dimensions taken of one of the men on the field. The relic's jaw was found to be an inch larger each way in proportion than that of the person whose measurement had been taken, although he was 6 feet 3 inches in height and weighed nearly 200 pounds and had unusually large jaws. The measurement of the lower maxillary found is as follows: depth 4 inches, width inside measure from wisdom tooth to wisdom tooth 2 1/4 inches, total length of jaw 5 1/2 inches. The upper was fully as large, while the teeth resembled those of a cow more than those of a human being. They were badly worn and would go to show that the owner ate meat, presumably buffalo, a great deal of time. A dentist, when shown the teeth, said that they were very much larger than any of those of a white person living to this age. A theory advanced is that these are the remains of some Mandan Indians, who were the earliest settlers of this part of the country, but were ultimately exterminated by the Sioux. The size of these bones would explode this theory, however, as the Mandans were not a large race. Indeed, nor were they racially aberrant in any manner with normal cranium and teeth. Another theory is that they are perhaps the remains of northwestern Indians who were killed by another tribe. This tribe was a large in stature tribe, according to tradition, many being 6 feet and more in height. The reporter found about 50 feet from the location of this trench another in which were buried the remains of fine grown persons and one infant. A spade applied to the earth soon brought to view the remains of 6 human beings. These skulls were much smaller and not of such extraordinary thickness or those that were exhumed from the first trench. They also bore the appearance of having lain in the ground for a long period, as they would crumble apart of their own weight, while those first discovered were in fair state of preservation. The cavities of the skulls had become filled with dirt, and it was only with great care and handling that a very fair specimen would be preserved. The trench was 3 feet square and about 2 feet deep. In order to place a human body into a small grave, it must have been fearfully mutilated. When found, the arms were over the head, while the tibia and fibula were found under all. The skulls were also found in different positions, some being straight up and straight down, while others laying face up or face down. No pottery, metal, or the like was found, by which they could be classified with the mound builders. But that's not the only articles. There's hundreds. I mean, literally, the list goes on and on. So let me read you a few more. A newspaper article dated June 15, 1930, found in the Clarksburg Daily Exponent, described something incredible being discovered in Doddridge County, West Virginia. 2 prehistoric Native American burial mounds were excavated by Professor Ernest Sutton of Salem University. He unearthed a huge underground chamber shaped from large, flat rocks and carefully packed with clay. Inside the chamber was a sitting skeleton, almost 9 feet tall. In an adjacent, even larger mound, approximately 10 feet high and 6 feet in diameter, he unearthed 3 burials, one of which was an enormously sized man, 7 feet 6 inches tall. In the November 18, 1897 edition of the Worthington Advance, an article describes the archaeological work being conducted by the Smithsonian Institute's Division of Eastern Mounds. Smithsonian ethnologist John Wesley Powell was excavating mounds in Iowa with the other researchers and unearthed the skeleton of what was reported to be a giant. The measurements taken indicated that the huge person must have stood over 8 foot 6 inches tall. Unfortunately, witnesses were disappointed to see that when it was exposed to air, the massive bones crumbled to dust. The Steelville Ledger, on June 11, 1933, reported that a young boy looking for arrowheads came upon the skeleton of a giant standing 8 feet tall. The remains were brought to the local doctor, R.C. Parker, and stretched out on the floor of his office hallway. The skeleton remained there for a while as some public spectators came to view the incredible find. An old photo found on microfilm at the Steelville Library depicts a local man, Les Eaton, who stands over 6 feet tall, laid next to the skeleton, to be shown in comparison. First reported in 1895, a 9-foot-tall Native American mummy found in San Diego, California. Closer scrutiny determined remains were closer to 8 foot 4 inches in height. Approximately 13 years later, the mummified giant was being displayed and was again examined by a second group of scientists, who determined the mummy contained an unusual amount of gelatin. To them, this indicated that the remains were a hoax. What's odd is that the same mummy was certified genuine by another group of anthropologists working for the same institution as the naysayers. Who's right and who is wrong seems to be a thing of debate. And the list goes on and on and on. You can look them up. There's numerous books on the subjects. It seems to me there was a race of giants living throughout North America and Central America, perhaps all the way down to South America. But they were real. They were here. Just sit back and think about it. What was it like back then? I mean, can you imagine it? Can you imagine coexisting with a group of actual, real giants? Terrifying. You're listening to Expanded Perspectives.
Back with Expanded Perspectives. I love the story of the giants. It never gets old for me.
Ever.
If you were looking on my bookcase, you'd see 12 to 25 books just on the subject from all over. It seems like there was a race, not just here in North America. Of course, that's the one I speak on the most because that's where I live. But in South America and Africa, Asia, every continent on the planet has a story. And I think that these giants, you know, they're not preposterous giants. They're not like Game of Thrones giants where they're 80 feet tall. No,
we're cooler if they were.
7 to 10 12 feet even, and there have been reported sightings. I know you're gonna somebody's gonna send some email in of one that was reported being 19 or 24. I've seen them too.
It's me. I'm somebody.
I've seen them, but I don't think that. I think some of those might be exaggerated, but still, a race of people 8 to 10 foot tall. You know, they have much larger skulls, double rows of teeth, polydactyl. These stories fascinate me. Their armor that they found, weapons, you know, helmets and stuff like that, helms, this stuff they found in these earth mounds and all over. And there's, I like the stories of the early explorers saying that they came to the island and they saw them. And they got off the boat. They mingled with them. They were just people, but just gigantic in stature. And then there's other stories of a cannibalistic giants. And these giants didn't like those giants. And then they were always having a battle.
I
like
it.
The stories like that. It's really cool. And it is weird that we're not taught this in school. You know, like you really are never told about it. Yet the Smithsonian even agrees that, yeah, that they've taken a bunch of these sightings.
Well, it's the same
way. You can't find them now, but they took them, and it's a real thing.
It's the same way they leave off a bunch of stuff with the Native Americans and they're the big, like, Cahokia. They leave all this stuff out like nothing was going on, right? And everybody knows, like, oh, there was a lot going on.
Oh, yeah, they make
it
out
popping.
Clovis first. There was nobody here. Clovis people, that's it. Like, it was just deserted and vacant. That's ridiculous. Why would it be like that? Why would it be like that?
I think it's been crazier for a lot longer than we're realizing.
Yeah.
Dude, I got another one to share with you that I got from Lon, too, because I'm on the black-eyed people kick, right? Now, I can't let y'all off the hook. Everybody over there in the UK, this is for y'all, all right? This is simply for y'all to let you know, keep your eyes peeled. It says this. I used to own an occult bookstore in Westminster, London, UK, about 15 years ago. Was it called Ray's Occult? Isn't that his name? Isn't that the one from Ghostbusters?
Yeah.
And it says here, the checkout counter faced opposite the store entrance. It was around noon and there were a few customers checking out. My employee and I were helping customers when I noticed a man in a light sweater walk into the store. Now, he looked normal, but was looking down in front of him. And after he entered and walked a few steps towards the bookshelves, he lifted his head a bit and I caught a glimpse of the side of his face. He then turned his head and looked directly at me like he knew I was watching him. Now, his eyes were as black as night. I was shocked and I just stared at him. I felt as if I was hit with a bolt of electricity and my knees weakened. My employee noticed my condition and literally grabbed me before I fell to the floor. I told her I was okay, that my blood sugar may have dropped and I needed to get something to eat. So I turned my back and walked to the small table behind the counter. But then I heard my employee say, "Excuse me, sir?" I quickly turned around and noticed the black-eyed man standing behind the counter only a few feet away from me. He stared directly at me, not saying a word. I was so frightened and suddenly ran towards the stairs and up to my office, hoping that he did not follow. I heard my employee tell him that she would call the police if he didn't leave. I remained in the office for several minutes. My employee walked halfway up the stairs to check on me, and I asked if he'd left. She said that he was gone, and I told her to close the store. It was a terrible experience, and I literally feared for my life. I haven't seen any other black-eyed people since then, but I was so affected by that encounter that I decided to sell the business not soon afterwards. I just can't explain why I did so, but I feel that it was important to be there no longer. Thanks, NK.
Wow. So it's either a guy who bought some fake contacts,
yep,
and was making a joke of you by trying to scare you or freak you out, or because you ran that rare bookstore, it was something demonic that
with
showed
that
up.
Occult stuff, exactly.
Something, you know, something that was conjured, or like you said, a warning,
a demon.
And you, I think you made a good move by selling the business because you don't want to get invested with demons like that. But you don't hear too many of the black-eyed adults.
No,
it does happen, but not very often.
No, you don't hear many of them at all. And think about the ones like that. What if they hadn't have sold the business? Right? Yeah. You see, and you're just like, I'm not getting rid of my business because I had like a weird encounter, and then something worse might have happened.
Yeah.
Because like we've talked about with the doppelgangers, some of these black-eyed kids and black-eyed adults especially seem to be a harbinger of ill omen in some form or fashion.
I agree. Before we get out of here, check this out. I have another story for you.
Hit me with it.
It says, I have been coming to the same area to camp and fish for over 30 years. The Twin Lakes Resort in Bridgeport, California, right on the California-Nevada border, about an hour north of Mono Lake. We talked about Mono Lake at the beginning. High elevation, tons of wildlife, and great fishing. The one-way road up to the Twin Lakes ends at the base of a huge mountain range north side of Yosemite. My parents brought me there when I was 5, and now I bring them and my family every year. So I am very familiar with the wildlife. On many occasions, I've had up-and-close experiences with many of its inhabitants. For instance, one time a bear was spooked and backed up into my tent, sending me flying over 2 other people that were in the tent. I've seen some stuff, it's easy to say. My family loves to fish, mostly catch and release, but sometimes we do eat some as well. My favorite pastime is hiking and bird and animal watching. I've developed a keen eye for locating and identifying all different types of wildlife. To give you an example of what I have personally seen in this valley, I've seen mountain lions, I've seen Sierra moose, bald eagles, golden eagles nesting, mountain goats, osprey, king snake, and the list goes on and on and on. The point I'm trying to make is I've seen just about every kind of animal that's in this wilderness, and I have a great knowledge of every other species of animal all over the world. Nature and wildlife have been a lifelong interest of mine, and have been the subject of much of my art since I was a child. Knowing the body parts and how they move together has been essential to understanding as an artist. Okay, I know. I'm getting to the sighting. My wife, stepson, and I were headed to the creek for some daybreak fishing. When we left before dawn to get the car parked, we had to walk to the creek. The time must have been close to 5:30 a.m., and it was still very dark and slightly foggy. This trip was about 1/4 mile from the cabin to the creek. It is always full of nocturnal animals heading home after raiding the local campgrounds. So, mule deer, black bear, and huge jackrabbits are always crossing the road, and it's no surprise. Like I have done 100 times before, I keep an eye out. I slow down, I hit the high beams to illuminate the beasts with their eyes, reflecting in my car lights. This time, my lights caught something crossing the road that did not have reflective nocturnal eyes. So I slowed down immediately to around 20 miles an hour and tried my best to identify what it was. I was having trouble doing so since this thing was moving very low to the ground. Its belly is just inches from touching the ground. It appeared very pale, maybe even white. So I think perhaps it's a goat or sheep or something. I immediately remembered decades ago there had been sheep herders on the side of the hill, but they'd been years, it's been years since many of them have been there. They've been gone for a long time. Well, when my high beams hit this thing, it turned its long neck and glared at us and almost shook its head as if it didn't want to be seen at all. At first sight, it was crossing the street almost diagonally, heading our way along the side of the road in our direction. Now, my wife had seen it from the start, but I needed extra time so that I could identify it and give her an explanation of what type of animal it was. I asked her, "What is that?" I just wanted to make sure she was seeing and observing the same thing I was. Now, the first odd thing that I couldn't understand, besides the way it was crawling so low to the ground, is unlike a hunting cat, the legs were all wrong. Its knees seemed to be backward, but it was running on them. My thought was that maybe it was an escaped sheep or goat that had broken its knees and was running for its life because it was moving so fast. As it came closer and closer towards us, I could hardly take my eyes off its freaking legs. I still lay awake at night, puzzled by how they were even working. I've not seen any mammal move this way. The closest thing would be a crab or an insect. The front and back legs moved together in unison. There was no bouncing, no swaying, galloping, or jumping like any kind of mammal. This creature's torso, which was about 4 foot long, stayed straight, low to the ground, as its arms or legs did all the work. To me, it looked like a puppet with a marionette moving it along. So unreal and fast, with only its arms and legs moving. Now, by this time, my wife could only get out, "What the hell?" as we saw it from about 50 yards away to maybe 20 yards. You could see it had no fur on it at all. Just pale, sinewy, stretched skin over long, skinny, well-defined limbs. Its broken knees were long, skinny fingers or claws, a foot long or more. The torso was maybe the size of a large goat, but it also had broad shoulders, very human-like. Possibly like this thing normally walks upright. This is what my wife kept pointing out. The shoulders made it look human almost. All this was freaky, but we both stared intensely to figure out what it was. As we got closer, the face became more and more defined. The first second we laid eyes on it, the face and head did not make sense. This thing looked like it came out of a horror movie, like a space alien creature or humanoid monster. The nose I was looking for was not there, just a flat opening with two nose holes high up on the face. It had no ears, just small holes on the side of its head. It had a high brow ridge-like bones, and the skull did not have a human cranium, more like the size of something larger, like perhaps a chimp. It had a large chin that protruded, maybe strong jaw bones, I don't know, but this part I don't get at all, the eyes. I saw these large eye sockets off in the distance, but they never would reflect in the light. When we were 10 or 15 yards away, I only saw sockets, no eyeballs, like that of a blind cave fish. Now this blew me away. How was this thing turning its head to glare at me if it had no eyes? Was it a ghost? I don't know. But as it passed us and I came to a complete stop, I saw it zip into the chaparral and kick up dust. This thing was flesh and blood, I swear. I might add that there was no smell or anything else odd around that we noticed. I should have taken pictures of the tracks, but I didn't think to do so because it was very puzzling. I thought maybe we had witnessed a ghost because of how unreal this thing appeared. I was also with my family, which I'm very protective of. Normally, if I'd been alone, I would have been on the trail. What was this thing? What was it doing so close to the campground still puzzles me. My wife said, even though I was only thinking it, this thing seemed intelligent and was creeping around in the dark, mad at us for discovering it. The mouth was closed, but it had tight, closed lips that almost seemed to grin. I did not see any teeth or anything like that. Its skull looked like that of a predator, not prey, with eye sockets positioned on the front, not the sides. I've seen a great many extraordinary things in my life, so I've learned to be a great eyewitness and not jump to conclusions, only observe, make notes, and then evaluate later. My wife is the biggest skeptic I've ever met, not fully believing the many extraordinary stories that I've told her. She comes from a lifetime of cold, hard, harsh reality. No room for any stretch of the imagination. Well, now she is a believer and is afraid to this day of what is walking around those Sierra Nevada mountains. Thanks, Sean. So again, with this cave-like creature.
Man.
But it's walking around on many legs. I think of the John Carpenter's The Thing.
Yes.
When the head like grows spider-like legs and walks off. It had a body size the size of a goat. Like, what? Maybe it was an alien.
Why do they got to keep getting creepier? Why can't the sightings get a little less creepy? They just keep getting creepier.
Well, I don't read the ones that happen in Texas on purpose most of the time.
Good thing.
It'll ruin all my plans, right?
How am I going to walk to the deer stand in the dark?
Well, this was way away. This is in California.
Nah,
so as long as you don't have
that.
A deer stand up there.
Don't worry.
You'll be good.
We're good.
If you have any cool stories you'd like to share with us and the listeners, do not hesitate. You can email the show expandedperspectives@yahoo.com. You can call the show 888-393-2783. Let's not forget about our wonderful sponsor, Fume. Join Fume in accelerating humanity's breakup from destructive habits by picking up the Journey Pack today. Head to tryfume.com and use the code EXPANDED to get 10% off when you get the Journey Pack today. That's TryFume.com and use the code EXPANDED and you'll get 10% off your order today. Cam, I'm heading to the coast. What are you doing, brother?
Man, oh man, I'm headed to College Station. Got to go get the daughter moved in for her last semester of school.
Moving from an apartment to a sorority house?
Yep, she's moving into the sorority house. She wasn't going to, but I think she got talked into, so that's what she's going to do for the last little bit. Literally 120 days, and then that's it. Graduation hits or something, and then it's over. So
you going to watch two-a-days? I'm sure those boys will already start.
We are going down there. Trying to think of when it is that we're supposed to. We're going to go watch a couple games this year, yeah. But, yeah, they're probably already at it or soon.
Oh, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. But
I don't know that they let off of it.
It's a lot easier now because they have these nice, beautiful air-conditioned facilities that all these teams have now. But when we were kids and you played in the heat, son.
Yeah.
It was two-a-days. No, they didn't even hardly water you.
No, that started in the morning, right? Like, you had to be dressed and on the field before daylight.
Yeah, I know. It's a different time. Thank God it's changed.
Did you ever think that your ears and head could echo from the shot of a whistle on top of a football helmet as hard or as loud as they are? Because it's just a little tin whistle. But to whip that thing and hit on top of that helmet and crack it when you're not paying attention.
Yeah.
And you're like, I think somebody just hit me in the head with a hammer, just a whistle.
I learned early on, and by the time, starting an optimist, but by the time I was like in the eighth grade, I was like, I'm done with football, man.
That wasn't big enough.
I'm not built for it. Yeah, no.
That wasn't big enough. Dude, we went to school like everybody. There was some monsters in our class. I'm like, no, I'm good, bro. I am good as gold.
Speaking as good as gold, you listeners are as good as gold.
Yes,
I hope everybody
are.
Out there is doing well. Take care. That's about all the time we have for this episode, folks. Till next time, I'm Kyle. He's Cam.
Peace, y'all.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at kosai.org.